This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. There will be a series of public meetings going on this spring and summer here in Northwest Indiana to inform residents and property owners about the latest involving the Northern Indiana Commuter Transportation District's double-track project, along with other projects, too. Let's find out the latest from NICTY's president, Michael Noland. Mike, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Happy to be here, Chris.
Well, fill us in first. Give us an idea of the first series of conversations, I'm sure, will focus in primarily on the double tracking project, but I'm sure there may be some updates as well you can pass along on the Westlake Corridor project. But bring us up to date first on the double tracking.
Sure. We just got some great news out of the federal government here about 2 weeks ago, actually 2 weeks today. Mm-hmm. Double track was moved into the FTA's engineering phase of their capital investment grant project. And so what that means for us is FTA has done a thorough and in-depth analysis of the project. And when you enter engineering, that's their way of saying they want to fund the project. We've got some additional tasks to do before we actually get a grant, but FTA has given it their stamp of approval, and we're working towards getting a grant early next year, starting construction in 2021 and finishing up in late 2023. So it's a really exciting time for the double track project.
How much of a financial benefit will this bring us here in Northwest Indiana? We know the project is a sizable one as far as cost and expansion is concerned, but how is the grant from the federal government going to help?
Well, you know, it's a $420 million project, so the federal government's going to be in for around 38% of the overall cost. That's a sizable contribution from the FTA. In 2019, the state of Indiana stepped up and provided an extra up to $205 million in funding to assist us in moving both Westlake and Double Track to conclusion. And ultimately, the projects open up access to the region for Chicago and provide the opportunity for about $2.5 billion of private sector investment and around 5,000 jobs that will be created as a result of these projects once they're up and running.
I know the meeting, which is coming up this coming Wednesday, which is going to happen at City Hall in Michigan City, is the first of the series of public meetings, really, I guess, that start out in February and move on into March and then even move on even later into the year to bring people up to date with the project. Go through the list and fill us in as to what public meetings are going to happen when and which people should want to pay attention to the meetings the most.
Sure. Well, the first one we're going to do is with the Michigan City Council. A lot of the council has changed, Chris, since the time NICTY and Michigan City entered into an agreement 4 years ago for how the double track project was going to move forward. So we reached out to the council. We've had individual meetings with a number of them, and we've suggested that we have a public workshop where we just walk through what the double track project's going to mean, specifically as we go through Michigan City, because as you and I have talked before, there's major changes that the double track project's going to bring on 10th and 11th Street in Michigan City. There's property acquisition. There's a number of crossings that will be closed. The remaining crossings are going to see significant safety upgrades with full gates, lights, and bells. And there's going to be a major station building and renovation on 10th and 11th Street between Franklin and Pine. So we wanted to have the opportunity to have the time to sit down with the council in a public setting and go through what our plans are and answer any questions and then move forward together.
Now, fill us in on what the March public meetings are going to be all about, because they're not all in Michigan City. Some of them are going to be in Gary, I understand.
Sure. So the part of this aspect here is that we're going to be acquiring a fair amount of property. And what we have done is scheduled open houses for the affected property owners in Michigan City and in Gary and in other areas along the line. We did that when we started the acquisition in Westlake. Mm-hmm. And they proved to be very effective. To start with a general open house for those particular property owners, whether it be a homeowner or a renter or a business where we're going to be acquiring their property, and then we have individual meetings specific to the individual properties. But we're going to start off with these open houses for the affected property owners in Michigan City and Gary on the 3rd and the 4th of March.
Mm-hmm. I understand, too, that you'll have the consultant that's been working with NCTI on the real estate end of the project here, too. So if people have questions, the realtor, so to speak, the experts will be there to answer them.
Sure. Beam, Longus, and Neff, BLN, is the firm that we hired for both projects. So far, I think it's going very well on the Westlake property acquisitions. The process is designed to be very beneficial for the homeowner, and so we are encouraged to reach a resolution, and we've reached resolutions with over 90% of the folks on Westlake where we're acquiring property, and we're hoping to have the same result here on the Doubletrack side.
Okay. Now we go into the month of June, and I understand that NCTI has a number of public open houses that are going to be held in various cities. Tell us how that setup is going to be and what folks are likely to find out from those.
So we're at about a 30% engineering design at this point, Chris, and we've hired AECOM Engineering to take the design up to 100%. Before we get there, we're going to have the plan sets at about 60%, and we're going to bring that vision to out so that people can take a look at it and provide us some of their thoughts. So that before, you know, if there's something that, you know, needs to be tweaked or modified, we've got a chance to do that before we get to final design. So that's what we're trying to do.
What kind of timetable are you still looking at here to get things started for first the double tracking and then, of course, for the Westlake Corridor projects?
Yeah, all things stay on schedule. We're looking to, for double track, get a full funding grant agreement from the federal government sometime late spring, early summer of 2021. And then we would immediately give a notice to proceed to a contractor to start building. And then we would hope to finish up by late 23 or early 2024 to start service on the double track. For Westlake, we're hoping to get a grant agreement from the federal government later this year, early fall, at which point in time we would then turn and give a notice to proceed to the design builder to start construction. Westlake's a larger construction project, so we would expect that that construction would be finished up in late 24, early 25 for start of service on Westlake.
I was wondering that because the Westlake Corridor project is such a big one, and it's an area where you're not just adding tracks and expanding and making improvements like I suppose you are with the double tracking project, pretty much, that it's a lot more involved to be able to have to go north and south and then make the connection to the main lines, isn't it?
Yeah, the complicated thing about the Westlake project is there's a whole lot of aerial structure that has to be built as we go over the Grand Cal, or we go over Canadian National, we go over CSX, we cross over NS and Indiana Harbor Belt. And so there's a lot of aerial structure in this project that has to be built that just isn't the case on the double track project. So it is a much larger project.
Do you think it's probably going to be about as extensive, or maybe almost, or we'll see in that, as what NDOT had to do for the 9-span bridge in Hammond to go over a whole railroad yard, basically?
Well, I don't know.
Maybe not that big, so.
I know about that project, Chris. But I do know that this is a lot of aerial structure, and that's really what separates it between the double track project that maybe is longer in length. We're building 8 miles of track for Westlake, and we're building 16 miles for double track, but the double track really doesn't have the aerial component to it. That's what really complicates matters.
Do you think that I'm sure people have probably had their comments up to this point, and certainly will make more during these series of public meetings coming up here for this one, this particular month, and then into March and into the summer months. Do you think that folks have had a better idea now that more information is out there and more will be out there to get an idea for themselves as what this is really going to look like?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, you know, as you know, we did numerous public meetings in 2016 and 2017, while we were advancing the project 30% design and to finish up our requirements of the National Environmental Protection Act. So we've already received a lot of public input, both from individuals and from communities up and down the line. And we're hoping to get more, and that we are looking for constructive input that can, you know, make the project better. So ultimately, that's where we're trying to go.
All right, Mike, fill us in on what websites people can go to take a look at not only the double tracking project, but also the latest involving the Westlake Corridor project.
Sure. We've got individual project update sections on the South Shoreline website itself. Mm-hmm. So if you go to mysouthshoreline.com and you go to the tab that says About, there's individual tabs that will take you to the Double Track Project or the Westlake Corridor Project, and they're both chock full of information on prior presentations, news about the projects, documents about the projects, the NEPA evaluation. And so you can go through and find a whole host of information about each of the projects just by going to mysouthshoreline.com and then going to the About tab.
Have you had an opportunity, certainly you get to meet with the contractors, the design people, as well as the people that are going to be doing the most work on both the double tracking and on the Westlake Corridor projects? Do you think that they're just taking the opportunity now and waiting to hear more, maybe in the last minutes, so to speak, from the public before they really start to go to work and really get going because you've got the deadlines coming up?
Yeah, well, you know, we went out for an RFP for design build services for Westlake in 2018. Mm-hmm. And at the January board meeting of NCDE here in 2020, we determined the current apparent best value proposer, the FH Passion team, to build the Westlake project. So we've got a proposal from Passion. We're in the midst of negotiations to try to get to an agreed upon construction price and scope. And so we're working right now with the FH Passion team for the double track project. You know, there's been a lot of interest expressed, we know, from the construction community. And I think there's going to be a fairly competitive process once the construction bids are put on the street. And we anticipate, Chris, that we'll put the double track project on the street for construction bids right around the first of the year, January 21.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great to know. We've been all watching and waiting to find out more, and we'll actually get to see some construction crews get out there and start work on the projects, to be sure. We've been talking with Michael Noland, who's the president of the Northern Indiana Commuter Transportation District, about the latest on the double track and the Westlake Corridor projects for the South Shore Line Commuter Railroad. And Mike, as always, thank you for spending time and going through all the details for us. We appreciate it.
No problem, Chris. Always good to talk to you.
Thank you. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Figuring out America's healthcare system can be hard for anyone. It can be especially challenging for refugees who often face significant language and cultural barriers. But there is one group that is trying to bridge the gap by training refugees as health navigators in their own communities. We have a look at a young woman who's providing healthcare lessons to fellow refugees from Burma. And we get from this in Side Effects Public Media's Natalie Krebs.
At a small, sparsely furnished apartment in South Des Moines, Iowa, Sipo Ross sits in the middle of the living room's brown carpet. She carefully sets out stacks of papers.
We have pre-imposed tests and then intake, sign-in sheet.
23-year-old Ra is in the home of a middle-aged refugee couple from Burma. She's here to teach them and their elderly neighbor about the flu and the common cold.
What kind of symptoms? Like, how can they spread, those kind of stuff.
The couple are dressed in colorful longi, a piece of fabric worn around the waist that's common in Burma. Their neighbor is still in her pajamas. They sit in a circle on the floor as Ra speaks. This small circle, as it's called, is part of Ra's job as a health outreach coordinator for a local nonprofit called EMBARC. That stands for the Ethnic Minorities of Burma Advocacy and Resource Center. Ra is also from Burma. She came to the United States through the official refugee program about 10 years ago. Like these refugees, she's Karen, one of the country's many ethnic minorities.
My family were first resettled in Lakewood, Ohio. We lived there for 3 years. I like it there a lot, but they don't really have a lot of refugee organization or support.
Now, Rod teaches Karen refugees about topics like the flu and mental health, which is rarely discussed in her culture. She says she has to explain concepts like stress and trauma.
In America, it's a big topic, you know.
Last year, more than 500 refugees were resettled in Iowa, including 128 from Burma. There are large groups in other Midwestern states as well. Nola Agner is with the Polk County Public Health Department. She says it's important refugees get extra help because they face major health issues from living in war-torn countries and refugee camps.
So it's a lot of just chronic health conditions. It's a lot of medical issues. A lot of times we're seeing individuals that are coming from the worst of the worst.
According to the Centers for Disease Control, refugees from Burma are susceptible to complex issues like hepatitis B, internal parasites, and malnutrition. They often have limited knowledge about these conditions and may need immediate attention. There are health workers statewide to assist them, but Embark's approach is unique.
Well, the big thing is that our health workers are actually from the community.
Mariah Morgan works with Embark's health program. She says refugee workers can catch assumptions and misunderstandings that American-born workers like herself might not get.
I might not realize that I need to take a couple extra minutes to define what, you know, tartar buildup is for your teeth, whereas they'll know immediately that this is going to be a new concept for my community, and I should probably take an extra minute to define it.
To become a community health worker with Embark, refugees first learn to be a medical interpreter. Then they go through a 40-hour training program. Ross says health coordinators like her are able to quickly gain refugees' trust.
Because we speak their language and we know their culture.
And this relationship can help refugees handle many details of their new lives. At the small circle in Des Moines, one of the Karen women asked Ra to translate a letter from a local hospital. Her daughter was recently in a car accident.
And then I was telling her this letter just to inform you that for her daughter, she has a little injuries.
On home visits, Ra spends a lot of time doing extra things like translating mail and making doctor's appointments. She likes doing it.
I understand what it feels like to be like in their place. When I first come to United States, I don't know any English, and all the culture and everything is very new to me.
Embark has 8 health workers who work with refugees from Burma, and more recently, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Natalie Krebs.
A recent study shows that state Supreme Courts around the country lack gender and racial diversity, and Indiana's no exception. All but 3 of the 110 justices in Hoosier state history have been white men. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith spoke last fall with the Chief Justice, Loretta Rush, who is the state's first female Chief Justice, about the issue.
So this report from the Brennan Center indicates that Indiana is certainly not alone, but its state Supreme Court, both currently and in its history, really lacks a lot of diversity. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
Why do you think that is?
I wish I knew. And we're looking at that issue because it really isn't acceptable. When you look at the role of the judicial branch and our responsibility and for the people to come, I mean, the 1.3 million cases that we have coming before us, I think it's important that our branch represent the diversity of our people.
Is this a problem that permeates further than the state Supreme Court? Is this a problem of the judiciary in Indiana as a whole?
I think it's a problem of all government. I mean, I think it's not just the judiciary. And I think the Brennan Center report is great because it also talked about different rationales that they came up with in their studies on the whys. And I just ran the numbers in Indiana so we could look at who are our attorneys in Indiana. We have 22,000. Attorneys, and they are able to, you don't have to put your race down. The majority do. So 75% are white, 3.24% are African American, 1.41% are Hispanic. And then when you look at the judges, we have 677 judicial officers, of which 80% are Caucasian. I mean, it sort of matches the same. 80% are Caucasian, 12% are unknown, over 5% are African American, over 1% are Hispanic. So what can we do to bolster those numbers? What can we do to sort of look back and tap on the shoulders to say it? And we're working on that. So when you look at the ICLEO program that we have, Indiana Continuing Legal education opportunity. We've had 605 graduates from the program, and those are traditionally law students of color, traditionally underrepresented as for diversity in it. And then going back even further, I just had a conversation with IU in Bloomington, Dean Parrish, in the last couple of weeks about starting a program for undergraduate students. Again, a feeder program to get more traditionally underrepresented individuals in the pipeline towards being lawyers and then judges. I have looked at, we make a real effort to, and we're successful in appointing a number of attorneys of color to some of our boards and commissions. Again, those are different ways that are a path.
I think when people hear about the idea of diversity, it feels to a lot of people like a box that just has to be checked. Oh, we need to be more diverse. Why is it important that our state courts are more diverse?
You know, I mean, I guess I'm a living example. I mean, when I graduated from law school in 1983, you know, less than 20% of the law school class were women. If somebody asked me, can you be a judge? We had never had a woman on the U.S. Supreme Court at that time, so I didn't see myself as a judge. Now, you know, I had a little girl send me, a fourth grader, her name was Maddie, and who I didn't know, and she sent me a picture of herself for History Day this year. She had a black wig on, thick black glasses and a robe, and she dressed up as the Chief Justice of Indiana. We were in the Supreme Court, and this dad was there with his daughter, and the daughter goes, OMG, Dad, the Chief Justice is a girl. I mean, I think you need to see it.
The two justices of color, Myra Selby and Justice Rucker, were both appointed by Democrats. Do you think there's partisanship behind some of the lack of diversity?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know the. I can't tell you that I see that. I'd love to see it on a nonpartisan basis, and maybe that would be another way that we could have a larger pool.
Thank you so much for sitting down and talking with me.
Thank you.
Getting a job can be hard, and if you're a military veteran or even a reservist still serving some time in the military, it's even harder trying to get a job. But there is a new study that's come out from a team of professors at Indiana University Northwestern Gary that have found that hiring veterans is actually good for business. So that ought to be promising for businesses and industries that are looking to, if they haven't already come up with the idea of adding veterans to their workforce. We have with us two of the three staffers that put together the information. We have a veteran himself in his own right, a professor of business administration, Charles Hobson. We have also economics professor, Micah Pollack. And both of you are in the studio. Thank you for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Chris, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Well, I understand, Professor Hobson, you are the fellow that came across the information that kind of sparked this idea of doing the study. How did you come across this and your first thoughts in getting the team members involved?
Sure. Chris, we've had many studies over the years that have looked at companies that have been identified as particularly strong in a particular area. So, for example, Fortune does every winter, they do an article on the top 100 companies. Mm-hmm. And we thought if veteran-friendly companies are truly stronger, that if we did a similar study comparing veteran-friendly firms with similar firms and looking at their stock market returns, that we would see a difference between the two.
Now, who did you turn? I'm saying you, I guess it's really a corporation, but we kind of personalize it here. Or what corporation, maybe we should say, did you all turn to in coming up with some of the information that got you started in doing the overall study?
Sure. So there's a magazine called GI Jobs that's published by a company called Victory Media that ranks every year the top 100 military-friendly firms. And we were able to go to their publication and look at their ranking. And, you know, we got details about the methodology of how they rank them as well, and then use that as a starting point for the list of military-friendly firms that we'd like to compare with similar firms that are not on that list, that are not identified as military-friendly.
That's probably a term that isn't used often, and maybe it probably should be in the future if it hasn't thought before, of what's called military friendly. How did you all come up with this definition that you got with not only the data that you had to work with, but also that you wanted to go forth in the future and do more?
Well, GI Jobs has a set of factors that they use to evaluate companies, in making the determination that a particular company is military friendly or not military friendly. So, for example, one of the factors is the presence of mentoring programs for newly hired veterans. Companies that have those kinds of mentoring programs are more military friendly than companies who don't have those mentoring programs.
Do you think that maybe it's because that they don't think about, having to kind of go even back even further, they have to take a particular type of person, the veteran we're talking about in this case, who somebody who's come off active duty or just finishing up their service, and have to go all the way back to when they were inducted and in turn went through basic training and learn how did that person particularly get into that mindset to be able to survive and function well in the military? You have a certain kind of mindset, I think, that you either, if you don't have it, you learn it when you become by the time you get through with your military service.
Yeah, so one of the things we also did is we looked through the literature and we identified 23 attributes that are often present in those with military training that might translate into a business environment. For example, strong leadership skills, teamwork skills, self-discipline, dependability, loyalty, and the like. And with that list, we have some guidelines for why you might think that an employee that has these characteristics might actually benefit your organization and lead your firm to be more successful.
Do you think that, as you discovered, there aren't as many mentoring programs in some of these businesses and industries that are out there that maybe if they learn that they can set up such a program that in turn will help attract more veterans to their workforce?
Yes, that's a point well taken. There are not a lot of companies that have mentoring programs specifically designed for prior military individuals. And the results of our study should provide some additional motivation for other firms to consider utilizing some of these more military-friendly features.
Now, Micah, how did you, in going through the data to be able to analyze things together that you work with the GI Jobs list of the military-friendly firms, and it's a list that maybe we should mention, which is not brand new. It's relatively new. It's what, about 3 years old, I think it would be now, almost four?
So it actually began back in 2003, but it's gone through a lot of iterations. And so in its current form, I believe about 2010 or so is when it kind of stabilized in its current form.
Mm-hmm. And what did you find that these are companies that not only are out there being well managed because they've done well, from the stock market point of view, from the business point of view, that in turn you could kind of follow through and see that they would be good for veterans?
Yeah, so the way our approach was organized is we first started with this list of 100 military-friendly firms, and then we narrowed it down to 64 publicly traded firms. And for each of those military-friendly firms, we identified a set of similar firms that are in the same industry, similar size, that are not identified as military-friendly. And then using this kind of matched sample, we took the military-friendly firm and compared it with the performance of the non-military-friendly firm, or the firm that isn't identified as military-friendly. And what we found is that on average, the military-friendly firms, the stock return was about 5.2 percentage points higher on average, or about 7.2 percentage points in terms of the median higher than similarly matched firms that are not identified as military-friendly.
So I guess it does give at least some indication, at least from this particular set of data that you got, and you're very quick to report this is not a number of years together. It's only a very short period of time, only one report or one set of data, which you can probably follow through in the years ahead, I guess, if you choose to do so. But you can find out whether there is a company or companies are out there that are well-suited for bringing veterans into their workforce. And maybe, as you mentioned, if they don't have the ways to be able to improve themselves so they can attract veterans, that it's possible they could do that then at least. So they're off at least to a good start. Maybe if they aren't initially being military friendly, they're off to a good start with the right information and the right impetus, I suppose, within the corporate boardrooms to be able to bring veterans into the workforce.
Right, Chris, your point is well taken that this is one study in 1 year, and you don't want to get too excited about those results, but to date, it's the strongest data that we have building the case, the business case for hiring veterans. We plan to continue our research and our collaboration with GI Jobs. We've got a couple of other studies planned and in the works, but to date. This is the strongest, most definitive data supporting the business case for hiring veterans.
In talking with the folks with GI Jobs, and maybe and even talking with getting some of the data together with some of these businesses and industries that you wanted to put together for the study, what kind of reaction have you gotten, at least initially, that they were even interested, that you all were looking into this on a serious basis, not just a frivolous study?
Well, I think that certainly among veterans and those that advise and support and help veterans, this has been a very welcome study. And again, you know, this is only 1 year's worth of data, but part of the reason that we wanted to push ahead with this as quickly as possible and then maybe have a couple more papers down the road that are kind of expanding on this topic is that there, as Charlie said, there really is no empirical study of the value of an organization for hiring veterans. And so this is very kind of a preliminary. It's not, you know, undeniable evidence that veterans, you know, returns to your firm are going to be higher if you hire veterans, but it is kind of the first empirical evidence. And I think we've received very warm welcome from those who work with veterans, from firms that are thinking about hiring veterans, from veterans themselves, because it does, you know, kind of put in a quantitative and empirical result, you know, what's going on. And they have something that they can point to and say, look, this is a value to a firm of hiring a veteran.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's a possibility that since we know that the state administration is very interested in workforce development and helping boost ways to bring more people into the workforce to be able to fill the jobs that are out there, they may be happy to be specialized, but the idea is they have firms that can do this training, get these people hired. If they bring veterans into the workforce, it's number one, it's going to help veterans to be sure, people looking for jobs, people coming out of the military service and looking for the jobs that get back into the workforce at home, or even maybe someplace away from home, like maybe they were living someplace else and not in Indiana. But the idea is that they'll be geared into these jobs, and that in turn is going to help the overall effort within the state of Indiana for more jobs.
Right. A couple of years ago, Chris, we did a week-long workshop with Work One with veterans who were unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked to them about the skills that they would need to get hired in the private sector. And I wish we had had the results of this study at that point, because it could have helped to increase their self-confidence, their self-esteem, to know that companies that do a good job hiring veterans outperform similar companies who are not doing a good job hiring veterans.
I understand that we have one other staff member that we haven't mentioned that we should bring into this conversation as a member of the team, and that's finance professor Bala Arshpanali. He was working with all of you, I guess, on this project. What was his this aspect that he was working on in particular?
I actually sought out Micah and Bala because of their statistical expertise. This particular study requires some very high-level statistical analyses, and both Micah and Bala have those skills. So both of them were essential in that regard in terms of doing the statistical analyses.
Did he have anything that he found interesting in the data that he passed on to you and made some remarks in your reports that you in turn put together for the final report?
Well, I think you may have been a little surprised that the results were what they were, you know, because, right, again, it is just 1 year and we're dealing with just 64 military-friendly firms. So to get the results we did with such a small sample, I think it was certainly surprising to him and to all of us as well.
Okay. Now, you mentioned you have more projects that are underway. They're planned in the future. Are any of them going to get started as recently as the next semester coming up on the Gary campus, or are you looking down the road even further?
Oh, we've already begun at least two more studies that kind of have resulted from this. Mm-hmm. The first is, you know, to look at a longer time period. So rather than just looking at 2016, we're going to go back to 2010 and look at the lists for each year and then track those firms over, you know, an 8-year period to see if this is not just a fluke and it's not just something that happened in 2016. And then the second study that we're working on is to get a little more detailed data from GI Jobs and try to figure out, okay, if hiring veterans is beneficial, what is it about hiring veterans that makes it beneficial? Is it, as Charlie mentioned, that you have, you know, training programs, or is it that you, you know, are making an effort to recruit veterans, or what specifically about being veteran friendly is translating into a higher return and better stock performance?
Now, I have to ask, because of Indiana University, of course, is an academic institution. Are you getting students, undergrad and graduates involved in some of this work on the projects that you're working? And certainly, you know that you're going to get some veterans that are going to be, I'm sure, interested. They'll be coming back to class, and if they haven't started school, they'll be starting school, and I'm sure they in turn would like to be interested in finding this own data about themselves, I'm sure.
We did, actually. It's a great question, Chris. We did have an undergraduate who was an Army veteran who worked with us in the early stages of our project and actually presented the preliminary results at a professional conference. So we have gotten veterans involved, as you suggested, and we look forward to doing that in the future. Currently, the gentleman who's the chief operating officer at GI Jobs, his name is Josh Rosen. He's also a veteran and very excited about working with us on the two projects that Micah mentioned.
Well, it sounds like it's data that that they can certainly put to good use, as well as you gentlemen at Indiana University Northwest, to be sure. Well, thank you, Charlie, and thank you, Micah, for being with us to talk about this study, and the best of luck in the other studies that you have already underway on the Gary campus.
Great. Chris, thanks for having us on.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, you're welcome. Charles Hobson is a professor of business administration at Indiana University Northwest, and his colleague with us today is associate economics professor Micah Pollack, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs just expanded its health care coverage of Vietnam War veterans who may have been exposed to the jungle herbicide Agent Orange, to sailors that had served on vessels close to the coast during the war. There's also a big expansion of the list of medical conditions associated with Agent Orange as well. The Deputy Undersecretary for Field Operations with the VA, Willie Clark, is embarked on a major public information campaign to talk about this expansion of assistance and to make sure that all veterans who'd served in Vietnam be aware that they may have been exposed. Will you give us a little background on some of the problems that members of the Navy have had? We're talking during the Vietnam era, actually during the Vietnam War itself, that seemed to be coming home, sadly to say, here in 2020.
This new law, the Blue Water Navy Vietnam Veterans Act of 2019, actually extends benefits to individuals that served within a 12 nautical mile area off the coast of Vietnam. If they were aboard certain vessels, of which we partnered with the National Archives and Records Administration to obtain over 28 million images of deck logs and the like. But previously, individuals, the Agent Orange Act didn't apply to individuals unless they had set foot on ground and then later within what was called a brown water area in certain inland waterways. Mm-hmm. But this new law, signed into effect by our president in June of last year, benefits effective in 1 January of this year. We've got especially trained individuals to do this work. As you know, Chris, thank you for your service, but over 57% of the individuals working with the Veterans Benefits Administration, including myself, are veterans. So we're happy about this opportunity to get the word out on your show and others. To say, come in to us, and because there are a lot of benefits there, and this long wait is over. We thank you for your service. These are things you justly deserve, and we want to help to file a claim.
One of the things I understand that with the changes that took effect on January 1st also included an expansion of the list of medical conditions that seem to be associated with Agent Orange. Tell us what the latest list includes, other than some of the things that we may or may not already know.
Well, there's this list. There are 14 diseases and disabilities that are extended to. If an individual is diagnosed with them, we'll make sure and get a copy of that complete list. There are 14. I don't want to start because I might miss one. But things like diabetes, we've got lung cancer, we've got prostate cancer, and there are several others that are there for veterans. We need you to just come in to us, benefits.va.gov, go in through your veteran service officer, your private attorney, call us. 1-800-827-1000, 1-800-749-8387. And we're appreciative of shows like this that gets the word out, that allows our regional office directors to go out and conduct town halls and others, because it is vitally important that we get that word out.
Mr. Clark, do you think that there are some people that, that would hear us and hear of these lists that know me about the situation with Agent Orange, but maybe never thought, number one, that they might possibly have the disease or the symptoms that show up there, because maybe their doctor in the past hasn't found these or hasn't even noticed them?
Well, and that's true, and that's why it's important for them to come to us and shows like this that we get that word out. If they're receiving treatment and those 14 disabilities, those diseases that I spoke to, alluded to, they're on the website, benefits.va.gov. Come in with medical evidence. If you have that, present to a VA hospital. And if you say that you want to receive treatment as a result of your service in Vietnam, they will provide free medical treatment. We're here for veterans, and we want to get the word out so they can come to us.
These vessels that you mentioned that you discovered over time, besides the usual ones that that might have been used in the inland waters, like well, I guess what you could call PT boats, the small craft that get around fast and make it through on the rivers, the Blue River Navy obviously has bigger ships than that. What types of ships might veterans who are stationed on those ships that are close to the shore during the Vietnam War might possibly have been on? What bigger vessels are we talking about here?
Well, there's a long list of almost 2,000 vessels. So, again, I don't want to name them.
Right.
What we do want to do, though, is if veterans can remember what vessel they were on and the time period, come in to us.
If you don't remember,
come in to us. We've partnered with these agencies to get these records, and we will work with them to assist them to get their claim ready so we can make a decision on it.
Well, as we talk here, getting close to the 1st of March 2020, and then the program began first of the year, what kind of response have you gotten so far?
We've gotten great response, but we need to get the word out more. As you mentioned earlier, there's always a certain number of folks that don't get that word out. And sadly so, a lot of veterans have passed on, so we're talking about survivors.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to continue to get that word out. That's what part of my being here, you're allowing me to come on your station, is about. So we need to just continue to do that.
Well, Mr. Clark, thank you for spending time with us talking in general. Again, go to the website, benefits.va.gov. Find out more about the expanded coverage into the problems that Agent Orange that was sprayed, of course, extensively during the Vietnam War, and how many more Vietnam War-era veterans might have been affected by this. Mr. Clark, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Willie Clark is the Deputy Undersecretary for Field Operations with the Veterans Benefits Administration. Republicans at the State House are advancing a bill to replace Indiana's method of quickly purging voters from its voter rolls after the current system was halted in court. But voter advocacy groups are arguing that the replacement isn't much better. Indiana tried to speed up the process by which it removed voters from the rolls by using a system run by the Kansas Secretary of State's office. That program, which critics said had deleted eligible voters, was halted in two federal courts. The legislation that was approved this past week by the Indiana House Elections Committee requires Indiana to create its own system, similar to Kansas's. Common Cause Indiana's Julia Vaughn says that's not a better solution.
It just perpetuates past mistakes, and if passed, will be challenged.
But Brad King, the Republican co-director of the Indiana Election Division, says federal law allows voters to be able to remove themselves from the rolls. And he says the new system tries to comply with that.
The only dispute we have is with regard to what extent a county can rely on the information it receives from a voter through a third party, through another state.
The bill is now headed to the floor of the Indiana House. And with another edition of Eye on the Arts, here's Micah Bornstein sitting in for John Kane.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and thank you for joining us for another edition of Eye on the Arts. I am Micah Bornstein filling in for John Kane, and joining me today is a delight. It's Maestro Kirk Muspratt from the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra. And every time I get to sit with Kirk, I'm just overjoyed. Kirk.
Thank you, Micah.
Welcome. You're welcome. So you're here today to talk to us about music. What kind of music, Kirk?
We're going to talk about orchestral music from the Baroque, classical, and romantic periods.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
Is there a specific show that you would like to talk about
today? We are going to talk about the Friday night, March the 6th. Yes. Concert at Living Hope Auditorium, which has blockbuster favorites, things that you've asked me for, not you specifically, but our our patrons have asked me for. And we're going to start the concert with the most famous piece that Vivaldi ever wrote. He wrote 500 concerti, but the Four Seasons is, of course, the most famous worldwide loved piece. And people have requested it, so we're going to play it.
Well, I would request things, Kirk, if I thought you would listen. But can you tell us what is so popular about this? Why do people love this? Do you have any idea, or is it just a mystery?
I think it's always a mystery. Why do people like the Doors instead of Three Dog Night? Why do people like the Stones more than the Beatles? You know, that kind of thing. It's magic. It's magic. It's magic. Why do people like certain things? But this, of course, is the first piece, Micah, of real what we call program music. Mm-hmm. It's the first piece that isn't just Mozart Symphony Number 28. You know, it is about the Four Seasons, and it's very depictive. You can hear the dogs barking. You can hear the shepherds, you can hear the wind, you can hear the ice, you can hear the seasons all encompassed in each of the four seasons. You can hear that.
That's wonderful. And I know that when we have these concerts that we invite people to play with us, it's very exciting to have soloists come in. And do we have soloists?
Is yes, Michelle Alekis, our concertmaster, who is very beloved by our patrons, is going to play. It will be the violin soloist for this.
And then I think I saw in the program that there's two soloists.
Yes.
Is there a piano soloist as well?
Yes. Yana Reznik, the great Russian pianist, well, now she lives in Chicago, who plays with all of the very best players in the Chicago Symphony. They love playing with her. She has played with us before, and she's going to come and play a piece from her homeland, the Rachmaninoff First Piano Concerto, written by Rachmaninoff when he was about 18, but devilishly difficult and ultra romantic, beautiful, like sumptuously beautiful, wonderful music.
Kirk, I think you're excited about this.
I am.
This concert.
I am, because I was sitting there.
His eyes were closed and he was
swooning. My eyes were closed because I love this music. And then also on the program, Micah, is the Beethoven Fifth Symphony, because this year is the 250th anniversary of Beethoven's birth, and the world is celebrating. And the Beethoven Fifth Symphony, I would dare to say, is the most famous piece of classical music in the world. It doesn't matter whether you're in Taipei or Sydney or Montreal or Brisbane or, you know, Edinburgh. It's ba 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 ba. And
there's no argument about it. It's number
one.
No,
and it changed history. You know, he changed history when he wrote that piece. There was no going back after Beethoven 5.
I feel like my heart's pounding the way you talk about
it. Oh, yeah. I'm passionate about it because he was so crazy and wonderfully crazy. He broke every rule in the book and didn't give a darn.
Well, I know that we are doing great at the Living Hope Auditorium. Our concerts are a delight there. How do you feel about performing this music in that venue? Are you excited about it?
Yes, I am, truly, because I like an intimate setting for music. I like where people can feel up close and personal to the musicians, where the music can actually hit you, like actually touch you, because you're close enough to it. You can feel an oboe, you can feel a bassoon, you can feel a cello next to you. Sight lines are great. It's easy to get to. It's very inviting, very friendly place, and I really enjoy performing there.
I enjoy being there as well and watching the symphony. And this concert, just to remind our listeners, is Friday, March 6th at 7:30 p.m. It'll be at the auditorium at the Living Hope Church in Merrillville, Crown Point, sort of on the border. And I want to thank Kirk for joining us today, Maestro Muspratt. And thank everybody for listening to another edition of Eye on the Arts. Micah Bornstein filling in for John Kane.
You can hear this conversation of Eye on the Arts and previous Eye on the Arts conversations online on our website right now at lakeshorepublicradio.org. And tune in again next Monday for another Eye on the Arts conversation here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Tomorrow on the program, we'll bring you a conversation with LaPorte Mayor Tom Dermody as he steers the city that he is in into 2020. And we'll also have an update for you as well, too, of the activities underway at St. Joseph's College in Rensselaer. All coming up on Tuesday's Regionally Speaking program.